You didn't step that one out.
Yeah. Start webinars. Was this yours? It's a pencil.
Yeah.
Recording.
Let's see what's over here.
Grant Johnson, whoever that is, and Liam Benson. Oh, there's Dr. Weiser. Okay.
You got rid of me?
Hi, it's Dr. Stephen Weiser from Alter.
Hi, Dr. Weiser. All right, I think we can start. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday weekly webinar, an open forum discussion. Glad to have everyone with us tonight. On behalf of NDMA, I thank you all for attending and for your membership commitment to NDMA. I'm Courtney Coble, Executive Director of NDMA. I forgot to say that. In COVID news this week, HHS is planning on releasing another $30 billion. This $20 billion of it will be distributed based on a hospital's proportion of total revenue, including money from private insurers and Medicaid. The remaining $10 billion is in the second round of funding, will be distributed with large numbers of COVID patients. So those hospitals in New York, in California, in Washington State, they'll probably receive the bulk of that. The first $30 billion was distributed last week, according to Medicare billings. So you should have received your portion of that. Also last week, President Misty Anderson and I attended a stakeholder meeting with Senator Hoeven. It was a really well attended a seminar because he had federal partners there. And so we were able to ask questions. And we emphasized the importance of telemedicine and continued funding for North Dakota physicians and health systems. Another reminder that I wanted to tell everybody is for PPE. There's opportunities with the North Dakota Department of Health, the HAN system. I just had somebody order some just last week and they received them already early this week. And there are also opportunities through the Gateway to Science in Bismarck. If you have any questions about this, you know how to reach me, please reach out to the office or email me and I can get you in touch with them. Finally, I wanted to touch on that one of the major topics that have been in discussion in all the meetings that I've been involved with is the return to elective visits, procedures, and surgeries. And really the consensus around those is that it really depends on what type of procedures and what type of COVID infections you have in that community. That concludes my updates, and I'm sure we're ready to hear from tonight's panelists. Tonight's webinar panelists are Joan Connell, Steve Weiser, and Kevin Mork. Dr. Connell is the field officer at the North Dakota Department of Health and of course leads the physician advisory group on COVID-19. Dr. Weiser specializes in emergency medicine and is president and chief medical officer of Altru Health System in Grand Forks. And finally, Dr. Mork is an anesthesiologist at Altru and is president of the North Dakota Society of Anesthesiologists. After the presentations, we of course will have opportunity for questions and open discussion. Please type your question in the question box, and if necessary, you may be unmuted if you need to present your question or follow up with other questions. So thank you again, and I will hand it off to Joan.
All right, thank you so much, Courtney, and thank you for all of the advocacy you do for us. So this week is an update from last week and the week before, .. So probably the biggest thing, I've been spending my time on is the provider concern issues that have come up, which is no surprise in this situation where it's a fast moving target and we have a new disease from which everybody's trying to better understand. And we have different expectations on patients and even amongst different providers, and a governor who's providing a lot of healthcare recommendations. So we have. Did call. And. We've reached out to several hospital leaders and
Joan, you're cutting out a little bit. I'm not sure if it's your connection.
Or two.
Joan, could I bother you to maybe disconnect and reconnect? Would that help, maybe? Just a few technical difficulties. We'll be right on the road again. While we're waiting for Joan, I just wanted to note that we're featuring, she takes excellent minutes at her physician meetings, and we do try to focus on those in our e-physician that's going out tomorrow morning. And so you can read up and read all the details about what the discussions were. All right. I think we're maybe going to go to Dr. Weiser right now, and then we can have Joan fill in when she resolves some of her technical difficulties, if that's okay with you, Dr. Weiser. So I will hand it over to you, and you are unmuted.
Thanks. Courtney, was it overall a summary of what our response has been to date and what we've done at Altru to deal with this? Is that sort of the catchphrase? That's sort of what I prepped today. So
that sounds just perfect. Thank you. Perfect.
So Altru, like every other health system in the state, has been in a prep mode for quite some time. And we went into incident command very early on in March. I think it was the 8th of March. By the 10th of March, we had a hotline set up. And I think within the following 24 hours, we had a sick clinic and drive-through set up for our city. We went on a ready alert status in January when we're notified about an outbreak in Wuhan. We're pretty well vested in emergency preparedness. Rick Letzinger and my leadership team, and Heather Standell and Kerry Jensen, are well versed in operational command. And unfortunately, over the years, we've had reasons to use that. Of course, we had a great flood in 97. It was a learning experience for an organization. So that, you know, you learn from lessons learned, but you can never imagine how difficult something like this is to prepare and react to. So I would say that the strength of our ability lies in the partnerships that you have. And we've established a great partnership with the state governor level down, from the Department of Health at the state through our collaboration with the Department of Health in our city. I feel as a collective unit, we have a very much an aligned ability to deal with what we've been managing through, up to and including last week, the outbreak we experienced at LM Wind Power. It just showed again, the unified command structure is the way to handle emergencies and how we are all interdependent. I think the governor's leadership has been exceptional, and is, you know, with Mylon Tufte and General Dorman there, the collaboration we've been able to have in terms of getting testing, ongoing surveillance has been second to none. In our region alone, we've tested over 2,100 patients so far. We've had 70 directly positive through our Altru testing, 171 in our service area. Our hotlines fielded over 7,500 calls. We've had, you know, probably in the neighborhood of 40 to 60 POIs that we've ruled out in the hospital. And we've had small numbers now creeping up of hospitalized patients. Most recently, census of today was 3 in our ICU, COVID unit ICU, and 3 on our 6th north floor, that one of which we were being able to transfer out. We were able to very early on collaborate and become part of the Mayo Coalition for Convalescent Plasma being a test site. And we were the, you know, 2 weeks ago, the first organization in our state to give convalescent plasma, and I'm excited to see that St. Alexis in Bismarck was able to do that for at least 3 patients. That's fantastic. Kind of showing the strength of North Dakota and that we do the best for all of our patients and our citizens. We're continuing to work with the state on this wind power outbreak that we're I think we're getting a hold on, but we've had a total of 115 to 125, somewhere in that range of positives out of that. And there is community spread that's gone beyond those families there. And actually some of our bigger challenge that if I could pass on a lesson learned to my colleagues in other organizations is that it really takes the city infrastructure, state infrastructure, and the local health systems to really advise these businesses how to do practice. You would assume that they know how to do safe practicing, but I will say that LM struggled in that. And as of yesterday, you know, we had very limited affirmation that they were able to get their people to listen to them. And we offered extension and help and provided guidance on, you know, what needed to happen. And that again was a collaborative effort between our city Department of Health, Altru Health System, as well as the state. And I don't think you can manage these types of serious events without having that degree of collaboration. We, as under the advice of the state, established surge capacity and worked with a few of the team through Ide Bailey at the state level to work through our tiered structures. And we're proud to say that we've rehearsed and walked through our tier structures. We're able to get safely through tiers 1, 2A and 2B. But those would put a pretty big stress when we're at a 2B. We'd be at 33 ventilators by that time and stressing our resources to the max, because that would involve anesthesiologists as well as hospitalist partnered with CRNAs managing large volume of critical patients simultaneously. We've addressed floor utilization in our hospital isolation units for COVID and maximized our bed capacity and how we would use that tiered process. And I think we've done a good job of that. We do have a total of 88 ventilators, but our surge predictive analytics place us closer to the 40 range, if at worst. And we hope we don't have to test that out. If we go to a tier 3, we certainly need state and federal involvement and probably a tent hospital put up, whether that's on the UND campus or one of our other ASC campus sites, to be able to support that. Few other things on the financial side. You know, part of the big things is understanding what are your resources out there. And through the CARES Act, we have been able to secure funding. We got our first initial payment about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago for the range of $10.6 million. We have taken out an advance on our Medicare patients. It's another thing that the government has been able to free up. So we took out an advance, as you know, most organizations, and I'm participating on multiple layers and tiers from state and federal and cross-state collaborations. Every organization is struggling just to keep their manpower up to play and be able to afford it, just because of the fact that our internal structure has been so upset, turned backwards, when we can't do the procedures that generate revenue to pay for the job, pay for the staff around you. So we also have been very proactive in navigating going forward how we're going to ramp up our services back to normal, but in a safe fashion, and create a safe environment for our patients and the staff in the hospital to be able to provide that care. And I've been a very key proponent from the governor level to our local level and national about testing. And you know, we have the ability to do some serology testing, but it's not really vetted out what that really does for safety. It just confirms exposure. We do have in-house testing finally, but we're limited to the staffing in the hospital and as well as the patients that get hospitalized. And we have been working very closely with the state and doing their turnaround testing in 48 hours, which has been great. But I think every organization in our state, region, and nationally would love to have 10,000 plus test kits so we can return back to normal or semi-normal in a work fashion and protect the workers, protect the patients when they're coming in to get their therapies delivered. Operationally, we've done like others. We've really ramped up telemedicine, and I think the future of healthcare is gonna look different. I don't think it's all gonna be telemedicine and masks. I think it's gonna be a combination of inpatient care, more thoughtful use of telemedicine for the cheaper aspect and access to care, and careful vetting of patients that they could be safe or do they need certain types of screening. But I see there's a plus and a minus to that. You know, and the one minus I would say, just as a physician, is, you know, part of our jobs as well as caregivers at all levels is to interact with people and their families up close. And that's something that this social distancing has really upset. And it has created a sense of anxiety, not amongst just the providers, but the people, you know. And you have that connection as providers, direct connections when you're working hand-to-hand, face-to-face with people. So we need to figure out how to do that in a new way. We continue our lobbying efforts at multiple levels on behalf of Altruist System. We're part of the Frontier Coalition with at least four different states around us, from Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, ourselves, and some of Minnesota, in terms of figuring out how we can be addressed differently, because we are segregated in regional health systems that support large population bases, and we should be addressed differently. So those are all positive things going forward. I'd say one of the biggest challenges as an organization that we face, as all others, is maintaining your morale with all these financial economic pressures going on in your communities and in the families that work for us, but also the anxiety of having this happen to you, getting ill with this and potentially getting critically ill. One of the things we did very early on was I was privy to a video that was forwarded to me from a doctor in New York City. It was after three weeks in the real heart of really bad situation for them. And he is a critical care doc. And he shared how he dealt with his anxieties and moved that forward. His name's Dr. Pierce, and he put it on Vimeo. And, you know, he developed a way to adapt to this. And it was a very thoughtful video that I shared with my widespread audience, including my region, to just give people the opportunity to see how people adapt in times of stress and how you can actually control and protect yourself with this. And we've shared that with our, not just our staff, but families and people who come in who want to watch that. So that's a pretty high level, pretty quick, robust. I think I'm very proud of our health system. I mean, the other thing I didn't really champion, which I think we did right out of the gate, was we have at least 13 critical access hospitals in our region. And I developed a collaboration with them within the first week. We went in operations, contacted all the CEOs and the medical staff. I made a off-roll, on-roll sort of program for patients in the communities to be sent to us and for them to be returned to support them as critical access facilities, but to also be able to accept multiple levels of patients and being able to send them back out to their homes and their communities when safe. Also, along with that, leveraging the use of telehealth and telemedicine support from both pulmonology care, hospitalist care, and emergency care as needed. So a lot of things have been getting done in the last 6 weeks. Don't see an obvious end in sight. See, just what we need to do is develop a new way of doing business and trying to get back to normalcy for people in a very abnormal, uncertain time. So that's a little bit of a sit rep from Altru Health System. Thanks for the forum to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Weiser. I'm going to pop back to Joan because I understand that she has another meeting to go to, and then we'll go back to Dr. Weiser with your questions. So Joan, go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks. And sorry for the, I thought it was your computer that was having the problems, and it must have been mine. So Dr. Weiser, I would thank you for your presentation. And I just really think that you and your staff are doing an amazing job in a challenging situation. And I guess I'm glad for you that you have all these experiences like Minot of very challenging situations, because you guys seem to be managing them well. And thanks for the tips in that Vimeo video. I think that'd be neat if you would share that with Courtney so she could share it with us. Okay, so my updates this week involve probably the biggest thing I'm doing with my time is addressing provider concerns that are identified through the COVID hotline. And that has really allowed me the opportunity to get to know many different administrators and CMOs to talk about someone's perception of what's going on with their facility or the care they're providing or the testing that they're not offering, et cetera. And once in a while, we do reveal some system issues like our tests are being rationed. Can you get us more tests? That sort of thing. Other times it's just reviewing policy, and I've been really impressed on a lot of occasions. Another thing that I focused on this week was the Homeless Domestic Violence Food Insecure Task Force. And I had been advocating from the start for a medical home for these people who were going to be housed in hotels. And indeed, the first couple nights of the Fargo setup, two people had to be taken to the emergency room. So DHS is much more supportive of having medical homes for these patients. We're working with community health centers, many of whom have stepped up to the plate to try and provide these services. But I do have an ask. We're thinking we're going to need 24-hour on-site nursing. So if those of you know of nursing staff who's been furloughed or their hours cut or whatever, who might be willing to provide that kind of service, the communities are Devil's Lake, Grand Forks, Fargo, Jamestown, Minot, Bismarck, Williston, Dickinson. Did I say seven of them? Or eight of them?
I think you did.
Yeah. Okay, super. So yeah, so let me know if you can think of anyone. And then in a few communities, we're also going to need physician providers who would probably need to be available via telehealth. One of the things that ties into Dr. Weiser's presentation regarding remote patient management is we are primarily through stuff that's been discussed in the physician advisory group, we have become acutely aware of hypoxia being way out of proportion to symptoms. These patients can be mildly tachypneic, and I have tried having people check respiratory rates in this telemed world that we ventured into, and the layman checking a respiratory rate is not hugely accurate so far. So we are really being aggressive about trying to acquire pulse oximeters so we can check patients' oxygen saturations who are being monitored as outpatients, primarily those we're starting with a group being housed in hotels. I also reached out to the telehealth task force that has monthly meetings. Marcia Wayne is in that group from Altru. Somebody in the last 24 hours sent me this brilliant idea. There is a tool that monitors vital signs via a watch, including pulse oximetry. It's this fantasy that I asked for. It automatically reports that to the physician's office, and then the physician's office will be alarmed if the numbers go below a threshold. So when we're talking about public health management of large volumes of outpatients, that would be very helpful. So I'm investigating that tool, and we're starting to experiment with twice daily pulse ox checks in this group of homeless patients who are positive. So for those of you who are managing outpatients, if that's something you want to consider doing, go ahead. If you have access to pulse oximeters, that can be rented through your durable medical equipment facilities, that'd be neat. If you have any great recommendations about this, feel free to get back to me because it's a moving target. In addition to that issue and there's a grant that's tied to that. And I had to ask this telehealth group when we met on Monday, if someone would please write the grant, because my Lynn told me I couldn't because I had to do this other stuff. So I think we have people who are helping to work on that. And I'm sure Marcia's one of them. So thank you. Thank you. The other thing that's coming up in the physician advisory group is we had to look at waiver of standard of care, and that brought up the issues that my special needs population have been regularly prompting me with. They brought it up at the newborn screening meeting yesterday about all of these states who have policies and procedures in place for prioritization of equipment like ventilators, and that is hurting the special needs population to the other end of this extreme, where the special needs population is insisting that they have access to like communication devices for hearing impaired 24/7 during surge. So we're trying to come up with a reasonable solution for that. We had to ask the Department of Human Services for help with that. So that's just the two interfacility thing is slowing down a little bit, but I'm going to jump back on that in the next couple of days so we can come up with something that is at least an understandable plan for families and for physicians who are providing care, which I think is really important. I will also let you know that I continue to advocate for some sort of protective law for healthcare providers in this time, so we don't put ourselves at risk of getting a potentially fatal infection, work hours on end, and then get sued. The third thing that's come up in the physician advisory group that Dr. Weiser also alluded to is the convalescent plasma program. I've been a huge fan of that, and I keep getting closer and closer to the state being very proactive about recruiting donors, both in the governor's press conference as well as mailing stuff out to our list of convalescents. So hopefully you'll see that in the next week or so. Dr. Weiser, you probably know this, but so Altru is the only major hospital who doesn't have Vitalant blood services. But so what would happen is the first unit would go to the facility, the Vitalant facility that the patient from whence the patient came, but subsequent units, and you can donate four or five times, could go to anybody. So I still think that's for North Dakota. I'm really think this is important that we have our own pool of convalescent plasma. Vitalant will have to share that with other states, but if we're using it as we're acquiring it, it, you know, in case we know that there are different strains of COVID, and if there's any change in reactivity and neutralizing ability based on strain, that would make me feel better to use our own plasma. The turnaround time is quicker, and it's ours. It's North Dakotan, so of course it's more robust. So stay tuned. And then the final thing, I have to jump off this meeting. Oh, one other thing about the PPE. So everyone's talking about let's get back into business. And I am not sleeping much at night because I'm worried about PPE, to be quite honest with you. I would assure you, or I would ask you to be really inquisitive with your within your facility. How many months of PPE do we have? I know we have 40% of the medical cash left, and I don't know what, you know, I don't know if we're getting new PPE stock tomorrow, next month, next year. I don't know that. I know Tim Wiedrich, who's amazing and kind of in charge of the medical cash, told me this morning that they're hoping that they're going to be able to do the Battelle procedure. They're number 34 on the list, so they think that this might be useful for us. But again, you know, I'm willing to put my life on the line to take care of patients. But if I'm putting my life on the line and somebody else is having 3 units of PPE used to have breast implants, I don't know how I feel about that. So point is, make sure that your facility has adequate amounts of PPE. And then final thing, so I'm jumping off this meeting because as Dr. Weiser also discussed, there's a meeting at 6 about serology. So I had heard in the press conference today that they're trying to validate that. I agree with Dr. Weiser. You know, so what if you have IgG? We don't know if that's protective or not. If I have IgG, I'd kind of like to go into a COVID patient room without PPE and see what happens. But nobody, I think, has done that study. So this meeting will be interesting, and I can't wait to tell you about it next week.
Great. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you.
Can you take one short question before you go?
Yes.
Dr. Wayne Anderson up in Williston, he asks about, I don't know if you heard the governor's press conference today, Joan, but I did. And he keeps telling everybody, there's enough tests. If you have symptoms, you can get tests. And Dr. Anderson said that's very frustrating because they do not have enough tests. And what should we do about that?
Well, you know what I would do about that, Dr. Anderson? I would call the COVID hotline and I would say, I am a provider from Williston who does not have enough tests. And I will get that complaint and I will start hooking you up with the people who dispense the tests. And that actually happened earlier this week. And the response was overwhelming for this small community provider.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you guys. Thanks everybody for taking such good care of patients and being such advocates at this time.
Thanks a lot, Joan. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. All right. I'd like to open it up for questions for Dr. Weiser now, if there's any follow-up to his presentation. Maybe he answered everything in his presentation. It was very excellent. Not seeing any. All right, maybe we'll, if he doesn't mind, just hanging out while Dr. Mork gives a presentation. I'll hand it over to you, Dr. Mork.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
All right. Good evening. For those that joined late, Kevin Mork, I'm an anesthesiologist at Grand Forks, and just going to take a few minutes to run through a few notes I had, and for anybody out there, if they have more questions or more specifics, I'm always happy to give you a call at your convenience and discuss shop with the help of Courtney and Leanne and the crew. Just let us know. I can always give you a ring or email or whatever. But as it gets late in the day here and our time goes, just wanted to have me talk about approach for intubation for COVID-19 patients. And really the approach is very much the same. It's just a little different now because of the infectious disease that this causes and how easy you can get it. But really the approach for airway management, whether it's in the OR, the ER, or the ICU, is very much the same, with the difference being this is a different animal we're dealing with. And as Dr. Weiser alluded to, there's a good video out there of a critical care physician in New York that kind of echoed what I felt about it anyway. And the biggest thing is you have to have the courage to step in and do what you need to do. And for me, it's not so much worried about being sick. I'm worried about not being able to work. So that's my issue. But protection is the biggest thing. And we do that anyway because we have patients out there, even in our part of the country. They may have tuberculosis. They may have infectious pneumonia. So the protection is still the same issue, but it's a little bit upgraded now with this little virus that we have. So really the idea is protection, eyes, ears, mouth, and hands. Because with a patient who's in dire straits, whether it's ER or the ICU, they're coughing, they're bucking. You know, the idea is that the droplets get into the air from saliva, aerosol, and it gets to your eyes, ears, nose and throat. I shouldn't say ears, but eyes, nose, mouth, and hands, because the key that this video that Dr. Price has from New York is, it's the idea is wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. That's really the key. But you want to protect yourself with gowns, goggles, and gloves. And as both speakers talk to, stewardship of your supply and knowing what you have and what you don't have, as even before you get called to do something. So do you have the masks you need? And it's M95s for us when we're taking care of these patients. Do you have a pair of gloves? You got a gown? And of course, eye protection, goggles, or a face shield. So being stewardship of supply is very, very important. And depending on the location of the patient, is very key for airway management, and our management is having the right equipment and the right pharmacy that you need. And we're going through the same problems that everyone else is watching our supply of pharmacy, because now with this new threat, we're using a lot of our routine medications much, much at a higher rate now for sedation for ICU patients, whether they're on ventilators or near needing that, and that's sedation, propofol, narcotics, Presidex, things like that. So stewardship of supply, knowing what you have and where your limitations are key. But as you walk into what we call rapid sequence induction, essentially what we're being asked to do is step in to a patient who's in dire straits, and in this case, someone who's in respiratory failure because of the COVID-19 infection, or in our case, if you have a trauma or someone with an emergency for surgery, say they have a hemorrhage or a vascular issue, what you're doing with a rapid sequence induction is you're stepping in to secure the airway as quickly as you can to limit, prevent hypoxia and further cardiovascular risk to the patient. And in this case, what we're trying to do with the COVID patient is not only protect ourselves, but to keep the patient from putting droplets or aerosol into the air as best we can to minimize that, even though we're limiting who's at the patient's head when we do this. And of course, you always assume they have a full stomach regardless of what's going on, so we're always worried about aspiration of stomach contents in the airway. And to start with, again, personal protective equipment, you protect yourself. We've been using for our limited needs here that we've had for the patients we've had, or the threats, say in the OR, if we don't know and there's a question that they could be positive, but we don't know that, is when we take care of the airway, we're going to minimize our staff. We're trying to have experienced staff, because usually with airway rapid sequence induction, which means you're putting the patient under unconsciousness and relaxing them so you can put in an endotracheal tube very quickly and efficiently. And the other thing we do is we're clearing the room. So other than the person or two taking care of the airway, everyone clears the room, so they're not standing in the room as they normally might be on a regular day with another patient. And so we have our equipment. Equipment's everything, having a backup plan for your laryngoscope. So if the light goes out, you have a backup plan or a backup blade, making sure you have the right medications you need in the right quantity, and having suction. In the case of COVID patients, suction has not been advocated, because when you suction, of course, you're getting saliva in and out of the mouth with and without your suction. So suction is something you'd like to avoid if possible. But again, to secure the airway, sometimes you need the suction, because if there's just, say, some stomach acid there, there's secretions, you have to see what you're doing. So suction available, because it's very important, but hopefully not use it. What we try to do is pre-oxygenate with oxygen with a tight mask seal. And what we're doing is trying to get a good oxygen reservoir in the patient's lungs. So for the hopefully minute or so that we need to secure an airway, where a patient has oxygen to draw from. What we're finding in our limited access to COVID patients here for the team, our teams that have been taking care of them, we can pre-oxygenate them. But we're finding that they desaturate once we start the process. Their oxygen saturation just drops like a rock, and it takes time to get them back, regardless of their status or their comorbidities. But we still like to pre-oxygenate as best we can to give a good oxygen reservoir or a supply while we're doing our thing. And this can be difficult because, depending on the circumstances, if it's an urgency, we got to do it right now, we're in trouble, versus emergent, where we should have done it 10 minutes ago. You know, you always have to consider and be aware of the situation too, and kind of be ready for those things more so now than before. But good mask seal. Now, if the patient's not cooperative, and that's often an issue, they might be under the effects of other medications. They could be scared. They just maybe have altered mental status. So if the patient's cooperative, that's fantastic. But if they're not, you essentially do the best you can. And that could be as simple as blow by oxygen in their face. But you're hoping for a good mask seal and also to prevent droplet spread. And as we start the process, what we're looking to do with IV access is render the patient unconscious. Typically, we use propofol or Etomidate for that. And right now our supplies are good, but nationally we've had an issue with supply, not just now, but over a few years. So again, we're watching our supplies closely, but we're rendering the patient unconscious. and then typically we'll give them something to provide skeletal muscle relaxation so that when we take that first look, we're not fighting muscle tone or reflexes of the patient, even though they're unconscious. And typically for that, we use something called succinylcholine. And again, we're having, as we've had for a few years, supply issues with it. So even now we watch closely what we're using and say, if we don't have it, do we have alternatives? Yeah, we have something called rocuronium, which is longer acting. So we always have something to consider in its place, which we have that luxury right now. And of course, with some of the medications we use, it's always good if you can know the patient's comorbidities. You know, if they're hyperkalemic or if they have a muscular dystrophy, we want to be careful of how we're using these medications just like anyone else. So awareness and being proactive of knowing who you've got and what's going on with them is always helpful. Once we start the process, though, we give the drugs very quickly. We don't do anything more at that point. Often what we'll try to do is, once the patient's unconscious, we'll give them a few breaths just with a bag valve mask and just to confirm that we can ventilate for them easy if we have trouble, and or to give them more of an oxygen reservoir. But in this case, what we're finding nationally and here is we're preferring not to do that if we can, because every time you do that, you can potentially cause droplets or an aerosol if you lose the mask seal, which can happen when you take care of any patient. But we are finding, though, when we do these intubations for these patients, they desaturate their oxygen and blood very, very quickly, and we're finding we need to take a few small tidal volumes to try to bridge that, because we're finding it takes a bit of time for the patients to recover, and a few minutes can seem like forever in these. But otherwise, you have your equipment. What's been preferred out there, and what's one of my favorites, it's called something called a GlideScope, which is opposed to the old direct laryngoscopy that we've done for decades and decades. The GlideScope is what I call the wonder drug of the 21st century. It's essentially a little camera at the end of the laryngoscope blade that you can see the picture on a screen, whether it's handheld or, in our case, we have they're on wheels and the screen next to the patient bed that we can move around. And essentially, for me, and this is another recommendation nationally, is we used to do something called awake fiber optic intubations on certain patients, whether they had old airway issues, be it cancer treatment, surgery, radiation treatment, or if they had an unstable neck, for example, from an injury or a neurosurgical procedure. We used to use fiber optic intubations with some sedation to secure the airway and preserve the neck and be able to, if you will, take your time doing it. In this case, that's not feasible. Plus, the issue with the fiber optic bronchoscopies is even with sedation, over time, they're not always perfect. You do need a measure of patient cooperation. They can be ugly, if you will, excuse the word, a lot of coughing and spitting. So it's really not something recommended out there. However, it's always another piece of your arsenal if you can't find your airway the other way and the patient's unconscious, but you need to have a good view. But we're finding the GlideScope is a fantastic way to do it, and I found, at least for myself and some of the studies I've looked at nationally, the GlideScope has almost eliminated fiber optic intubations in the United States because it's very straightforward. You can get pretty good at it even in a difficult patient, but the thing we're running into now, even here, and it's not new for us, but now amplified because of everything, is a short supply of disposable blades for a GlideScope. So again, it's something we have to be aware of, and we're typically using less of the GlideScopes routinely in the main ORs or for other intubations, and trying to make sure we have a supply for these patients, because again, you want to be very efficient and minimize the time that you're don't have an airway for these patients once we've started the process, because they can get very unstable quickly. But again, as I said, what we try to do is minimize who's there, so that if it's the ICU room or even the OR, what we've been doing even just the last couple days is the main anesthesia provider is there doing everything, and the second one is just standing outside the door ready to come in if needed. And then sometimes you, with experience, you can kind of see two sets of hands are often better at the beginning of something versus stepping in. But you want two sets of hands that have a pretty good idea of what they want to do and how they're going to do it. But having said that, as I would say to some of our pathologists, you never know where you're going to be or what you're going to be asked to do if we're stretched for care providers. As long as you know what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, you can always instruct somebody who's assisting you with a little motivation and just say, just do this, hand me that. That can be done very good, very nicely. And as I said before, too, when you go into these situations, whether it's emergently or urgently, the patient issues, they could have a bad airway, an airway exam, as I would call it. I might look at them and say, yeah, they might be a tough one. They might be someone who weighs 400 pounds. You can have a lot of redundant tissue between the back of the tongue and seeing the opening of the airway. Of course, there's always aspiration issues. You can have patients that are claustrophobic if you even try to put a mask near their face, whether or not they're wearing a regular mask for protection of trying to eliminate droplets in the room. A lot of folks are very claustrophobic, so that's something you have to work around. And they might be uncooperative. They might have dementia. They might be frightened. They might have the effects of other drugs that they've had for sedation. And you always have to take the whole picture. One of the other things we've been doing here is for a patient movement, someone that might have it that we're suspicious of, what we've been doing with our OR use is we simply bring them directly to the OR, take care of our procedure business, and then we're able to very nicely, because we've been able to, we recover after the procedure right in the OR, or if they're coming from a COVID ward or our COVID ICU, we can take them directly back there for recovery. So that's been very, very good, where we're very direct and we're planning ahead as to what we're going to do and how to handle it so that we don't kind of get caught with any surprises. And then really just to finish up here quick, I didn't go into drugs and doses and all that, but if anybody wants that, I can always give them a ring. But again, for just in concluding is really protection of the providers so that you can continue to provide care, avoid the droplet aerosol production into space around the patient, whether it's cough, suctioning. And the one thing that we do too is when we put in an endotracheal tube, not all of our medications are always as potent. They're not unsafe, but potent, where you can get a little bucking of the patient, where they're moving a little bit, and anything can cause droplet or aerosolization. So we watch that pretty closely. There are advocates out there, too. We haven't gotten into the situation yet where if they want to exchange a tube out, say we've intubated someone, and over the couple of days, the cuff that we use to help secure the tube in place has got a hole in it or it's leaking and we exchange the tube. One of the recommendations that I've seen is just taking not a sharp pair of clamps, but padded, where you just are able to clamp the endotracheal tube, have everything ready, and simply take it out. So as you take it out, they can't try to push air aerosol through the tube out the end, and then just reinsert a new tube. So the little things that we come across as things come up. But again, is we're looking at too is more so for the primary when they first get in. If you look on YouTube or out there in some of the emails we've gotten, is making hoods to cover the patient's heads, where I've seen everything, and these are ingenious things that one can do, is one of the big Tupperware Rubbermaid tubs that you can say buy at Menards, that's big, and you basically would turn the top would be to the patient's foot, and you cut armholes in the bottom, and that's how you would take care of a patient, just putting your arms through the holes to avoid just more aerosolization of any patient breath or coughing, and or taking some simple plastic pieces, making a frame and putting plastic, clear plastic or semi-clear plastic over to make a hood, if you will, to do the same thing. And they're good ideas. I think they're using them more out east or in the States where they're having more of a problem right now. But like any airway management, as long as things go well, it's good. But if you're having trouble or having trouble seeing or have to get more hands to help, that's where sometimes they could be a bit of a predicament where you're protecting you and the patient or the room, if you will, but having trouble because the hood that you're trying to protect everyone with is actually sometimes impeding your progress. But that's, again, with experience, that's how you learn. Where, regardless of whether it's the ICU, the ER, the OR, the code blue on the ward, the GI and pulmonary lab, where we're we still have other business going on. So just not the people being sick, but we still have other people that need their appendixes out. They still fall and break their ankles. They still need bronchoscopies to get biopsies to rule out cancer. And with that, I think the thing that I've been thinking ahead of for, say, bronchoscopy, if we need to do it, is typically we'd have the mouth open. More so with bronchoscopy, we can just do an intubation and do it that way. But if, say, we're doing an upper GI on someone who has issues where securing their airway might be a little hazardous, is taking a simple oxygen face mask or non-rebreather and just cutting the hole you need for the endoscopist to use that while we give the patient sedation and they're, if you will, not quite conscious, but tolerating the procedure. So there's a lot of new ways to look at things. Otherwise,
well, thank you, Dr. Moore.
No, and HEPA filter. HEPA filter, either between the mask or the endotracheal tube in your bag or your ventilator, or in our case, the oxygen circuits. HEPA filter. And so far, we've been very fortunate. We've got what we need. And as Dr. Weiser mentioned, we've been very thoughtful of what our use is, how we're taking care of people who need things done that wouldn't say are elective, but they need to have business done in a timely fashion. So we've been very fortunate with that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mork. We've got a couple hands raised, so I'm going to unmute Dr. Kumar. He was first. So Dr. Kumar, you have the floor.
Thank you. That was a very nice presentation. How about when you are like, there is controversy about when to intubate, like do you tolerate hypoxia and oxygen up to like higher liter per minute, or do you?
It gets to a point. Now, I haven't had a lot of direct care with the patients we've had. More so would be our critical care docs that would have a better answer. But I've understood that you can just get a very high oxygen flow and still be losing ground, where they desaturate and they lose their with their pulse oximeter, they continue to decline and decline. And I think that's, again, I'm afraid in time I'll have a lot more experience with that judgment that our critical care docs have had for the few that we've had here. Is, you know, it's a judgment call where you're looking at what you've been doing, how high you've got the oxygen, but turning up the oxygen, I found if they're getting into trouble, probably isn't going to help you. And as I said, those are the kind of patients where you can pre-oxygenate and really make an effort, and they're seconds into the process, they just desaturate down to low, and those few seconds you need to secure their airway seems like forever. And it takes many, many minutes to get them back. Typically, we get them back, but it takes a while. So I don't know if that answered your question, but.
I think Dr. Weiser said he wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Kevin for his great presentation on airway management. Regarding these patients, Craig, I would say that, and Dr. Kumar, like very early intubation, if they're starting to desat, the respiratory rate's picking up, and they are having progressive dyspnea, the experience out there, just working through channels with various other organizations in my ER critical care network, lessons learned are no BiPAP, no aerosolization, no high flow that just aerosolizes particles, puts you at risk, other people at risk, and really, as much as possible, catch them before they fall. Now, there are some. What I mean by that is intubate. Now, there is some more recent literature, but that, because that some of that is like several weeks old now, even a month plus. Some recent literature says if you can create a closed system that can function with some PEEP, closed meaning no secretions, you know, HEPA filter in place, no aerosolization or breath being extended outside of that. And there's some unique systems that were developed, and one of the sites I'd suggest you go to is emcrit.org. And they look like almost a BiPAP kind of setup with an AMBU bag and an oxygen reservoir. And you can do a contained system and try to bleed a patient along and avoid intubating. You know, there's if you look at the critical care literature now, after 4 to 6 weeks of heavy experience with these patients, a lot of them will need a ventilator. That ventilator will be a prolonged course once they're on there. There's just a common path they go down. But you kind of, it's one of those situations, if you ever dealt with an asthmatic, you don't want to intubate an asthmatic, but when you got to do it, you got to do it swiftly. And it's a lessons learned kind of phenomena. And that's 25 years of ER experience with that type of patient population. So I do think there's going to be more closed-like systems coming out. And again, I'd refer you to EMCrit and Josh Farkas. That's emcrit.org. And Josh Farkas is a pulmonologist critical care guy who kind of put something together that way so that his hopes were to avoid intubating. And some patients can get over the hump after a couple of days using that. But that's really cutting-edge stuff. But by and large, no BiPAP, no high flow if they need to progress intubate right now, unless you can find or build the closed system I'm talking about. We at AllTrue actually bought a bunch of AMBU bags with oxygen reservoirs and HEPA filters in place, and we have built them to be able to be used here in order for that reason to avoid intubating where possible. So,
thank you. I'm going to unmute the next questioner, Dr. Croach. You may have to unmute your own line too.
Oh, sorry, I didn't have a question, so I must have accidentally hit the button. Sorry.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Mork or Dr. Weiser? I agree, both excellent, excellent presentations. We kept all our attendees too, so congratulations to both of you through the whole hour. Any questions? Raise hand and feel free to reach out to me and I can pass along questions to Dr. Weiser, Dr. Mork, or to Joan. And Dr. Anderson, I will pass along that further information to Joan. I'd like to thank everybody for attending. We're really happy to have these for our members, and I appreciate everybody attending. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Courtney.
Yeah, thank you.